Okay, so this is another simplified way of recording. So last week we had spoken about chastisement and how when devotees offended the deities, Prabhupada was very upset. Or if something very important was not done well, Prabhupada was very upset. And then I remembered a chastisement I got, and I got it through a letter. But it was interesting because in the letter, I wasn't chastised, but I found out from Prabhupada's servant that I was chastised, because Prabhupada told the servant what to say to me. So then the way he said it was nicer than the way Prabhupada said it. So I'll explain the story. And this story relates to grihastha life and the sometimes the switch from brahmachari life to grihastha life, which is sometimes very difficult to make. So men were losing, obviously you lose some freedom in grihastha life that you had as a single man. And in those days it wasn't so much the financial anxieties or the loss of financial freedom, because it didn't cost much to live in America in the early 70s. The ratio of how much money you could make and how much it cost was not really a struggle for anybody. Everybody could live quite easily. So the anxiety that the men were having was just they felt restricted because they had a wife, family, they couldn't move around freely like they could as brahmacharis, and then all the other responsibilities that go with it. So it was quite common in those days that somebody would get married and they wouldn't make the switch from brahmachari to grihastha. They'd still, because the movement was very much a preaching movement. So it's kind of like the grihasthas were still, you know, there wasn't, externally there weren't a lot of people in the congregation who were working. So the lifestyle externally of the grihasthas and brahmacharis was very similar. So when you got married, often you didn't really make the switch because your activities didn't change. You were still doing your service, whatever it was. Now you were just married. And you were, the temple provided you some simple living facility. So the men often never made the switch from brahmachari to grihastha because they were still living like brahmacharis, more or less. But they were just living with their wife, but sleeping on the floor, going on book distribution all day, going on traveling sankirtan, like that. So I think because of that, it was common that when men would get married, they started to feel like this marriage is a burden because I'm doing the same service, but now I have to deal with wife. And that restricts my service because I want to be at the temple. And she says, well, you know, we're never together, so come home, spend time. No, but there's Gita class tonight. No, but we never spend any time. But you're gone all day on Sankirtan. There's no time at night in the morning program. So they were feeling that burden. Or they'd want to go out traveling, so they couldn't really go. Or if they'd go, they'd have to come back within a week because their wife would ask them to come back. And sannyas meant you're just traveling and preaching. And so many of the men loved preaching, and you know, we were young, and we, you know, young men when they're married, they don't have many needs. They didn't want much. So when you get older, you want house, furniture, car, wardrobes, hundreds of clothes and shoes, and whatever else you want. I don't know. You know, whatever you want. Big speakers. Whatever. You know, it happens later. So we were all young. So basically we lived like brahmacharis. We just lived with our wife, but there was no furniture. And we slept on the floor. We only had a few possessions. So because we were renounced, a lot of the men felt, well, what's the point of being married? Because I'm just doing the same service, but this is just getting in the way. At least not everybody thought that way, but some men thought that way. So, a lot of men, after being married, felt that maybe they made the wrong decision. And so it was common that they would write to Prabhupada and in what they felt was sincerity, saying, I just want to serve you, I just want to preach, I don't want any other entanglement, so can I take sannyas? So kind of like, I made a mistake, I'm regretting the mistake because it's inhibiting my service to you. So their feeling was, I'm just writing, asking to take sannyas so that I could do more service. And in some cases, Prabhupada actually gave sannyas. I think he understood that some of the men who got married would not actually be capable, not out of irresponsibility, but they were just too renounced. They didn't have any interest in married life, so they actually couldn't do it. It was like some people just aren't good at certain things. Somebody can't cook, somebody can't write, it's like that. So I think in some cases Prabhupada saw that. This person is very renounced, they're very Krishna conscious. Being sannyas is natural for them, being married it doesn't work. And if their wives saw that it didn't work and it was going nowhere and gave their permission, then in some cases Prabhupada would say okay, because he understood that these people would not fall down. And being married was just, it wasn't working. That was the exception. But in most cases, he would say no. But he was getting many letters like this. It was quite common. It was, and getting letters from even men who had children, young children. But their desire was, at least they thought, we just want to preach, and we made a mistake. We didn't realize that grihastha life would be limiting. We thought it would be helpful together, the wife and I would preach, but once your wife has children, then she can't, she's restricted. And wife needs time, and if the mantra of those days, the wife's mantra was, you never spend any time with me, or you don't spend enough time with me. That was common mantra for the wife. And that would frustrate a lot of men, well, what do we do when we're together? We just waste time or something. We want be out preaching, And so basically the married men would just be hanging out with brahmacharis. So they were like brahmacharis. So their wives weren't happy. So I was one of those who wrote the letter to Prabhupada. One of the frustrated grihasthas. And Prabhupada, he describes this in the Bhagavatam. He said there are two kinds of renunciates, one who's actually renounced and one who's frustrated. And they're not actually renounced. They're just frustrated. They can't enjoy, so they renounce because they can't enjoy. But their heart is not free from the desire to enjoy. So it looks like they're renounced, but it's just they're not. They're just, okay, I'll give it up. Why are you giving it up? Because it's like an old car. I'll give it up. Oh, you don't want cars? No, I don't want this car. It's not that I don't want cars. But at that moment, I think cars are a hassle. I don't want cars. But then, a few months later, I see a nice BMW. My friend says, you want to use this? And you say, oh, yeah. Yeah. So something like that. So Prabhupada understood that many of the men were frustrated. And they weren't actually renounced. But they couldn't distinguish the difference. They thought they were renounced. Just like anytime you get very frustrated with something, you detach from it because it's causing you pain. That's why we detach. What's his name? In the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali says, attachment comes when you enjoy something. Think about it, right? Think about anything you're attached to, right? It's because you enjoy it. That's where the attachment comes. And to think about anything you're detached from, then what does it come from? It comes from pain. You experience suffering and you become detached. So any attachment you have in your life, generally it's because you enjoyed something. So let's say, I have this one attachment, I've become a devotee, I have this one attachment. Why do you have that one attachment? Because you really like doing it. Not because you got frustrated with it, right? Not because before you were a devotee, it just frustrated you, or some part of your life you just got frustrated with this. That's what you're detached from. So Patanjali says, whatever gives you pleasure becomes the thing you become attached to. And when you remember that pleasure, you want to do it again. And that's where attachment comes. So detachment is the opposite, right? And so when you suffer with something, you become detached. But when you forget the suffering, you want it again, right? So you have a relationship with a man or a woman, and it's frustrated, and it's, I never want a relationship with another man or a woman. But a year later, things change, and you think, oh, but you know, it's nice to have a relationship with somebody, and you remember the good side of the bad relationship, or you remember the good side of other relationships, and you want it. So it's the enjoyment that creates the attachment. And if you're not actually detached, then the frustration will detach you temporarily until, again, the attachment arises. So this was happening in our movement a lot. In fact, Prabhupada was giving sannyas to some men who then, later on, men who renounced their wives and took sannyas, and then later either went back to their wives or remarried with other women. So I actually wrote Prabhupada twice, because one time he said, I think the first time he said, you can take vanaprast. So I thought vanaprast meant, well, I could leave my wife. That's what Prabhupada was saying. But vanaprast technically means that you won't have any more children. Like it's kind of like, okay, yeah, it was awkward. Prabhupada said you could be vanaprast, I was 23. But that made sense for us in those days, because vanaprast meant, okay, just go, just focus on preaching. Vanaprast meant, don't buy a house, car, don't get entangled. It's okay, just go, you know, just don't have any more children, just continue your preaching. That'll be vanaprast. So you kind of live a simple, renounced life. Prabhupada, knowing or feeling that sannyas was not the right thing for me and not the right thing in that situation, he said vanaprast, but I took vanaprast. I was like, oh, now I can leave my wife on vanaprast. So then she wrote Prabhupada, and she was completely distraught. And she wrote Prabhupada, and he said, I didn't mean that he'd leave you. Anyway, I was giving Prabhupada a lot of trouble with my inability to balance renunciation and attachment. So it was just a question of balancing. So I forget what everything else Prabhupada said, but he did say, oh, so then, because I wrote two letters, and I think the next letter came a year or two later, when I hit like this high level of frustration, and I said, I just really am frustrated with this whole thing, and I really want to take sannyas, because I was just a book distributor, and that's all I was doing. And I was basically living like a brahmachari, you know, always with the men. And I think that's when Prabhupada said you could take vanaprast. But what Prabhupada told his secretary, that his secretary told me, when Prabhupada was read the letter, the way it worked was that Prabhupada would get letters and his secretary would read the letters, and then Prabhupada would dictate the answer. And the secretary would write it down, and then the secretary would type it out, maybe put it in his own English. Prabhupada would read it and then sign it. The Prabhupada would approve it. So this is how the secretary told me it went. He said, Prabhupada, another sannyas letter. He's getting a lot. Then Prabhupada would say, from whom? From Mahatma Das. And he said, tell him he's a nonsense. That's what he told me, the Prabhupada said. But it didn't come out that way in the letter. But I guess that was a code for, you know, a certain explanation that Prabhupada was giving to all the grihasthas. But Prabhupada said something really important. And he said, don't want to give sannyas, or I don't give, or I won't give sannyas to any grihastha is first not an ideal grihastha. And then, in other letters, Prabhupada said to grihasthas that if we're divorcing or we're doing this, we just become a laughing stock for society, because the people will look at devotees and say, look at your social structure. Your men get married, then they leave their wives, then they marry somebody else. They become renunciates, and then they marry someone else. It's just a laughing stock. So one thing that was happening that you'll know, that you, if you actually did a study as if you were doing your master's or PhD in the evolvement of ISKCON, and you could look at its involvement in many ways, but one of the things that you will see happening is that Prabhupada's responses to the same situations changes because he's getting data. You know, in research you get data. You do surveys, right? You ask people questions, or you observe over a period of time trends. So Prabhupada was getting the data. And what was the data saying? Men are giving up their wives very easily. So now Prabhupada's, he's dealing with something that was unheard of in India. In India, men don't do that. They don't take sannyas and then get married again, generally. If they do, maybe they go back to their wife. So Prabhupada's observing now what's happening. So decisions that he was making about certain things, at one time, he would change. And he would say, no. And it came to a point where he said, no more sannyas. And early in the movement, if you wanted to get married, you'd write Prabhupada for his blessings. Say, Srila Prabhupada, I want to marry so-and-so. I need your blessings. And he'd say, okay, you have my blessings. Then, maybe by 1972, there were so many divorces, and so many for Prabhupada meant one. One was already too many, but there was obviously more than one. It was becoming quite common. Men were frustrated, like I was saying, they're frustrated because they really want to remain renounced, like brahmacharis, and they can't as grihasthas, and they get frustrated. And often they were leaving their wives in their frustration. They felt that grihastha life was just an entanglement. Or they didn't get along well with their wives and spend a lot of time fighting. And so they were quite frustrated. So around 1972, Prabhupada expressed a frustration himself in that so many devotees were getting married, and he said, I don't know how he said it. He said it, but if you want to get married, do not approach me, just approach your temple president. He didn't want to bless any marriages. I don't know if that's how he said it, but basically it meant you don't approach Prabhupada if you want to get married for his blessings. You just go. He said something in effect, I'm frustrated with this, that you're so irresponsible. So if you want to get married, don't approach me, that's your responsibility. You take it upon yourself, you deal with your temple president. So, as I said, that was an evolution in Prabhupada seeing us and our condition. So there was another evolution later, no more sannyas, because so many sannyasis were falling down. So they don't want to give any sannyas. There was another evolution with brahminical initiation, because brahminical initiation meant first initiation, okay, it was given liberally, but the second initiation meant you have to be able to follow these four principles strictly because you're Brahmins, and Brahmins means now you're Satvagun. So, you know, you get first initiation, whatever, it's a chance. Okay, take Diksha, make your vows, here's your chance to come to Satvagun. But second initiation, the idea was you're in Satvagun, and if you're in Satvagun, then you can follow the four principles, because it's only passion and ignorance that would cause you to break the principles. So that was the idea. So then so many first initiates and second initiates were falling down. Prabhupada was getting letters, you know, from leaders who were falling down. And Prabhupada, he sensed it. And he, in one letter, he said the problems in our movement is that the leaders are not following the principles. There's a letter like that. So he knew what was going on. So then he became strict with second initiation, or even first initiation, but especially second initiation. So he's observing what's going on, and he's seeing the real nature of his American disciples. And what Prabhupada was doing was he was bringing out the best in us, right? But eliminating the worst in us is a gradual process. So while he was bringing out the best in us, whenever we got slack, the worst in us would come out also. So we were quite a contradiction. We were quite a living paradox, because we were amazingly surrendered to Prabhupada and amazingly fallen when we weren't careful. So we were like patients in ICU, intensive care unit. And if we just deviate a little from our sadhana, our tendencies could overtake us. And sannyasis falling down, all kinds of fall downs all over the place. Sannyasis, you know, whatever. So then Prabhupada, seeing that, he became more strict about giving sannyas, giving second initiation, and then he stopped blessing marriages. It's just like, you do it at your own risk. He didn't want to get involved. And as a sannyasi, it really wasn't his position. But I was just reading something yesterday about this man. He deals with corporations, and he helps them change the culture and the values. And he said that It all involves people changing, and it is really difficult for people to change, and it takes a long time. But what you want to do is focus on the good and get the best out of people, and that way you try to minimize the worst. So that's what Prabhupada was doing. He was getting the best out of everybody. And that's why sometimes it doesn't make sense when you see somebody who did so much service, who was so, apparently seemed so advanced, later on had so much difficulty. It was because Prabhupada was getting the best out of them. And difficulties, that's anarthanivritti, so that comes as you progress in devotional service. But the fact that they could serve so enthusiastically wasn't based on their level of Krishna consciousness. It was based on their love for Prabhupada. So they may have been on a low level, not anarthanivritti or not nista, but just their devotion to Prabhupada was so intense that they could serve that way. And I think this is true for all of us, because when we connect with our guru, we become very inspired. So we're very surrendered, and we serve and enthusiastic and so forth. But there's this other side, and sometimes you don't know about the other side because you're so much engaged in devotional service, and you're so happy and you're so enthusiastic. You lose touch with that other side because you're kind of transcending it. Not actually transcending it in the sense of you're on the level of transcendence, you're just transcending it because of your enthusiasm. But if you lose that enthusiasm, then you come back to your actual platform, and then that's when you run into trouble. So we are operating on two levels. And so Prabhupada was just knew that if we had good sadhana, we wouldn't be troubled by our anarthas. But when our sadhana got weak, or something came up, some problem came up, then it would come out. And so a lot of times we'll see amongst devotees, something that's often bewildering to us is that devotees who are very good, very Krishna conscious, will exhibit some traits that are not Krishna conscious, and we get confused. How could they say that? How could they do that? So that's part of what's happening, is that the bhakti, the sadhana, the dedication to guru, it's all pushing them forward, but their actual level of bhakti is much lower than what's going on with their body externally. And when they get a little slack in devotional service, then those anarthas become manifest. So that's why sadhana is so important. We have to be so careful. And then what was happening with these grihastha men, I would say two things were happening. The men that wanted to take sannyas, there was a desire to serve Prabhupada which was not based in balance and maturity. So no mature man would leave his wife, right? You talk to any Indian man and say, oh, you have a new child, are you thinking of taking sannyas? They'll think you're from another planet. They'll think you're crazy. What are you talking about, taking sannyas? My child's 1 year old. They'll naturally be thinking, when the kids have gone to college or when the kids start working, then we can think about vanaprastha, maybe we'll move to Mayapur. generally you'll see the Westerners will move earlier, younger age. The Indians will think, okay, when I'm 50, 55, then I'll move to Mayapur. You know, they'll think more in those terms. So we're a little more detached, but that detachment sometimes gets us into trouble. So there was an immaturity, thinking that the responsibility to grihastha life is not that important, the responsibility to preaching, that's what's important, so why not take sannyasa? I was just reading a letter yesterday, really heavy actually. This devotee was neglecting their child. She was a pujari and she was neglecting her child. And she was fully engaged in service and she was letting other people take care of her child. And Prabhupada wrote her a letter and said, I can't believe that you're letting other people take care of your child. Like, you know, I guess she was neglecting her child for the whole day. I mean, not neglecting, but personally not being with the child. So in that sense, neglecting. And Prabhupada said, your puja is child puja, not to the deities. Because she was pujari. He said, that's your puja now. So we didn't understand that. Because we always thought, well, children and family, wife, husband, you know, it's like, you're a Sankirtan devotee, you don't want to stay back and cook for your husband. Prasadam, that's like Maya, you know. So there are many women in that situation, you know, lamenting, I'm a Bhuktashtri, my husband wants me to stay and cook for him and clean the house and do his laundry. I could distribute, you know, like 20 Bhagavad Gitas. Right? So, that's what we were dealing with. I mean, there's truth to it, you know. Somebody else can cook, or you can take temple prasadam, you know, why keep your wife back? But you understand the thinking. So, there's a lack of maturity, and then this idea of attraction and then renunciation was just inability to balance. Because in all of us, we have one side that's renounced, and we have one side that's attached. Right? Like, you like living in Mayapur, you live simply, you're happy, you're living a simple life. So you're living a renounced life. Right? So you're happy. But at the same time, you want a family, you want a house, which is natural. So you have both things going on, right? So we have to learn how to balance both. Because if we get out of balance, then it's not real. Because you have both things going on. So most people, unless they're very Krishna conscious, they have attachment and renunciation at the same time. And they have to balance it. So they're not so renounced that it's beyond their level of renunciation and it's artificial. And then they crash, or they don't allow their attachments to overcome their spiritual, or overcome a certain level of renunciation that's healthy. So we have a tendency to be imbalanced because we don't really understand. We're not, maybe not realistic about who we are and where we're at. So maybe we think we're more renounced than we are, or sometimes it works the other way. Somebody thinks they're more attached than they are, and they kind of give up on renunciation when they actually have the strength to do it, but they don't try or they don't know how. So I see both things going on. It's quite common. They're extremes of either end. And one thing I noticed about Prabhupada is, like, sometimes he would say things that if you took them out of context, you would think are very narrow, very fanatical, and broad generalizations. You know, like you say, all men are this, all women are that. That's a broad generalization. People are... Grihastha life is this, brahmachari life is this. It's a very narrow statement. And sometimes Prabhupada would make those statements. But I always noticed he would balance it with another statement. And I noticed that we tend not to balance it. We tend to focus on one side. Especially when we were younger devotees, we would hear classes about one thing. Just book distribution, just that's it. And you wouldn't hear classes about Harinam Sankirtan, college preaching, to opening temples, you know, the need for proper deity worship, we'd just hear the class on book distribution. Or we'd hear the class on women. We didn't hear the class how women are mothers, women are to be respected, women are our sisters, women are our gopis. Oh, we just heard that woman is an entanglement. She's personification of Maya. And you're thinking, you know, you're a woman sitting in the classes, so how does that make you feel? You are a personification. That means wherever you walk, it's like you're just like, you are the personification of Maya for every brahmachari in the Hare Krishna movement. Even maybe for some of the grihastha men. You also might be a personification. And how does that make you feel? I'm amazed that there are any women left in ISKCON after hearing all that in those days. You know. But Prabhupada also would speak about the grihastha life as the dark well and so on and so forth. But then he would say, but a nice husband, Krishna conscious wife come together, it's very powerful, and they can do so much. And he would balance it out. So he because both points are true. And when you emphasize one side without the other, you don't give the whole picture. Because when you emphasize one side, it makes it sound like the other side is not true. But both sides are true. Right? Grihastha life is an entanglement. At the same time, it can be a very potent form of preaching and a very necessary ashram for most people. So they're both true. So if you're a brahmachari, you take the entanglement part. That's what gives you strength. If you want to get married or you're already married, then the other side of making it work, it's an ashram that you need to make work, which will help you come to a higher stage of renunciation eventually. That's the part you focus on. So if somebody focuses on one side and not the other, as a teacher, you just left out part of your audience, right? And if somebody focuses on one side or the other, it's probably, I can't say in every case, but there may be, it may be that they themselves are not fully balanced, which is why they're not focusing on both sides. So when we were young, we were definitely out of balance. And so we would focus on one side. And then if some grihastha would come and say, well, grihastha life is good, this or that, then the brahmacharis would get upset. Ah, he's in Maya, look what he's preaching. So there was this out of balance situation. So to be an expert as a preacher and to be normal yourself, you have to be balanced, because if you're not balanced, your preaching will be unbalanced. It's all like this, it's all like that. This is all good, this is all bad. And it's not like that. So that's what we were dealing with in those days, of our desires to become sannyas. So Prabhupada made that wonderful appointment, that wonderful point. First become ideal, grihastha. Then we talk about sannyas. Right? So that's, you know, so you become ideal, grihastha. Then you become renounced later in life. Then that's normal. And the other, I was saying, there's immaturity, there was out of balance, and irresponsibility. So there was, I think definitely at that point, what Prabhupada had to deal with and what was going on within our hearts was there was a little bit of a reluctance to be responsible. So responsibility means, in some sense, restriction. Like, okay, you're going to be grihastha. So there's things you can't do now that you did as brahmachari, and there's things you have to be responsible for that you were not responsible for as a brahmachari. And many of us who become devotees, when we became devotees, it meant we could give up all responsibilities for material life. So whatever it was, we dropped out of. Most of us just dropped out of university. Most of us were not working. We're in university, or we just graduated. So we were dropouts. So that was, you know, for us, that was great. You know, we dropped out of university and we didn't have to enter the workforce. We joined ISKCON. I personally remember one of the motivating factors for me to become a devotee was so I didn't have to enter the material world, the material life, because I didn't want to enter it. And so this was like, we all were hippies, wanted to drop out, and this was like the full course of dropping out, become a devotee. So it's now I have no responsibility materially. And I move in the temple, I don't have to worry about anything. The food is there, the place to live is there. I don't have to work. Right? So we carry that mentality into our grihastha life. And so there, when people were writing Prabhupada, let me take sannyas, it was this mood of, I don't want to be responsible for this. It's just a burden. It's a headache. And so Prabhupada had to deal with that a lot. And he was dealing with irresponsible people who were not committed, who made commitments at the time of marriage, who gave them up. We'll just go, but it's difficult, let's give it up. Thinking that that's what that would please their spiritual master, and thinking they're doing this in the name of doing more service. So this is really interesting, because the reality for many grihasthas is that their service will be restricted in some way, especially if they were brahmacharis and now they're going in the workforce. That means 8 hours of their day that they were preaching is now done in an office. So naturally, they may feel frustrated or restricted, right? And so it's an adjustment they have to make. Which is why what we're doing in our Soul Tools project is trying to create a facility so Brahmins can preach and they don't have to work in an office. So basically they get married and they continue their same service. But it's a difficult adjustment to make, and people have to make it by taking responsibility. Or you're a book distributor, now you have a baby. You're very limited when you have a young child, and everything changes. And if in any way you can't neglect your children, it's like, I'm not. You may lament, I'm not doing any service. I'm just taking care of my kid, or I'm just working. So those adjustments have to be made. And a lot of people got married and they didn't make those adjustments, and then it all came out in strange ways. And then Prabhupada had to deal with it all, unfortunately. And try to set us right and correct us. So, at this time, a godbrother of mine had also written to Prabhupada. He had a one-year-old child, and he wanted to take sannyas. And I told the story before, but what's one I think is very significant point that Prabhupada made to him, he said, didn't it cross your mind? It was like Prabhupada was surprised. He said, didn't it cross your mind that you will be causing distress to your wife if you leave her with a one-year-old child? Didn't you think of that? And when I reflect on that, I think none of the men were thinking like that. They were just thinking, I want to get free from this, just travel and preach and save the world. Because this grihastha life is preventing me from saving the world. It's just getting in the way. I know how they were thinking, because that's how I was thinking. And Prabhupada, he's reflecting back and he's saying, don't you realize how much distress you're going to cause your wife? And obviously you're the father of a child, you're just going to leave your child. So then Prabhupada said in the Gita, I believe it's chapter 12, or the chapter on divine demoniac qualities. There's chapter 12, I believe. And Krishna lists all the qualities of one who's dear to him. And he lists one quality as one who never puts anyone into difficulty. And he's very dear to me. So Prabhupada quoted this verse. He said, do you not consider the difficulty you're putting your wife in? Krishna says, one who puts no one into difficulty. So none of us were considering that. And then the second point that Prabhupada was dealing with, and this was coming out in the letters. Well, actually, it may not have come out in the letters, but it was in the minds of the devotees, that now that I'm married, I can't make spiritual advancement. It's just like, you know, I'm with this woman, and, you know, it's just like, it's not like being with a brahmachari. You know, it's like with a woman, it's a different world. And she's physically attractive, so I'm attracted to her, and that's just a deviation from my mind, and we're off together and it's so nice, and you know, it's like sense gratification, you know. We like one another so much. And it's, you know, so it wasn't always that they didn't get along. Sometimes they got along really well and the man would think, oh, I'm just forgetting Krishna, this is too nice. Mm-hmm. So as a young devotee, they're looking at this and thinking, okay, this is bad. And they're thinking, I can't be Krishna conscious in this situation because I'm so attracted to her and I forget Krishna. You know, like we can write a song. You're so beautiful that when I look in your eyes, I forget everything about my spiritual life. So that's there in the Bhagavatam, in Kardama and Devahuti. So Devahuti asked Kardama, before you take Vanaprastha Sannyas, give me a child. So he said, okay. And so he wined and dined her, so to speak. He created a beautiful palace for her in the sky, and they enjoyed. And then they had a child. And in the purport there, Prabhupada says, when a man's enjoying with a woman, he forgets everything about his spiritual life in that moment. It's like the enjoyment is so intense. It's just like, the more intense the enjoyment, the more you forget about your spiritual life. I remember when I was becoming Krishna conscious, I was living in Berkeley, and I went to some course. And I forget what the course was, but it heightened your sensual experience. So I understood Krishna consciousness, but through this course, we were having heightened sensual experiences. And in those heightened states of sensuality, I was thinking, what is this Krishna consciousness? This is, you know, this is like real. This is real, tangible enjoyment. So when your senses are stimulated, when materially you experience high levels of happiness and gratification, sometimes you just forget your spiritual life. It's like, you're like so happy. It's like, isn't it? And distress is distress is when you're more Krishna conscious. You know, things aren't going, it's really tough, the weather's hot, mosquitoes are biting, this and that. Isn't that when we're more Krishna conscious? We do austerity, go out on book distribution, deal with all these people who are just giving us a hard time. We go, this world is so horrible. Right? But if if immediately we took you to Brahmaloka and there were beautiful men and women and you're drinking soma rasa, wow. It'd be hard to remember Krishna. So for some men, I can only speak for men because we're going through this. So for some men, it was like they were basically feeling and writing to Prabhupada, I can't be Krishna conscious being married. It's like, you know, just around a woman, and it's like, it's so, that's the entanglement. Female, male, that's the main entanglement, and I get around it, and I just fall into Maya. Now, we could say that they misunderstood Grihastha life, or they didn't approach it right. That's another issue. But Prabhupada addressed this in the letter, and he said that this is how a neophyte will think, that the external environment, I'm dependent on the external environment for my Krishna consciousness. He said, your Krishna consciousness does not depend on married, not married. So he wanted to make this point because we never got it, because we were thinking, once I'm not married, I'll be Krishna conscious, and as long as I'm married, I won't be. Right? So that's what Prabhupada had to help us. He said, no, it's not dependent on being married or not married. It's not, you know, how nice your wife is, how nice she isn't, how beautiful she is, how beautiful she isn't. It's not dependent on those things. It's dependent on you. So we didn't understand these things, and that's why we were writing these crazy letters to Prabhupada. I can't be Krishna conscious at home. I just want to preach. And then, you know. But Prabhupada, obviously he understood the nature, the condition of our heart, that externally there was this enthusiasm, which was definitely genuine. But inside, there wasn't enough Krishna consciousness to sustain that enthusiasm. So it's really interesting. And I was just writing a devotee the other day, and I was saying, he was asking me about pure devotional service. At what stage does pure devotional service start? Because different acharyas give different explanations. So I was saying, it's really an interesting phenomenon if you look at it, that when people joined ISKCON, they completely dedicated themselves to Prabhupada, purely, just solely for Prabhupada's mission, solely for Prabhupada's desire, Prabhupada, whatever you want, I'll do it. At the same time, their level of Krishna consciousness was very low. But their level of devotion to Prabhupada was very high. So it was an imbalance, and it couldn't be balanced until they become more advanced. So when Prabhupada left 1977, many people could not exist without him. Because their enthusiasm, their level of bhakti was low, their level of dedication was high because of Prabhupada. But without that person, they were now left with their level of bhakti. So when your spiritual master leaves, it's very revealing, because it shows you more where you're at in Krishna consciousness. Because when he's around, he's always inspiring you. You're always, always inspired. And one of Prabhupada's godbrothers said, when your spiritual master leaves, you will have to question your own Krishna consciousness, because you're actually confronted with it. And you don't realize it until he goes, because then you realize, oh, I was getting so much inspiration, or I was getting so much clarity. Now I'm confused. Now he's not there to clear up things anymore. He's not there to continually inspire me. So that's what goes on. There's this high dedication, which is wonderful. I'm not minimizing it. But then you have your own level. And so we all thought, because we had all this enthusiasm, we could renounce on this high level. But the reality was, we weren't realistic about our own Krishna consciousness. So then this brings up another point. We can see from this that devotees didn't actually realize where they were at in devotional service. They just looked at their enthusiasm and thought, well, because I'm so enthusiastic, that must mean I'm very Krishna conscious. And it doesn't mean that. Just because we're enthusiastic and dedicated, we have to look at other factors, like our anarthas, like our steadiness, our influence, the modes of nature, how we're being influenced by the modes of nature, and other attachments. So that then brings up the point or the question of understanding how to be realistic about your own spiritual advancement, and therefore what you need and what you can accomplish. Because it's possible that we could try to chew off more than we can swallow. If you try to chew off more than you can swallow, it gets caught in your throat. Mm-hmm. That's an American saying. He chewed more than he could swallow. Right? Here's a case here. Can you imagine I tried to eat this case? And you're all looking at me thinking, you can't eat this because you can't swallow it. Maybe this I could swallow, this little piece. It's a little plastic piece about an inch. I could swallow that. So if we're not realistic about where we are in Krishna consciousness, then we could chew off more than we could swallow. And I think that was happening a lot. And I think it was really difficult for devotees to understand where they were at, because the level of ecstasy and dedication in Prabhupada's presence was very high, and therefore you were surrounded by this high level of enthusiasm. And it was in that situation, naturally you become enthused. And it's really difficult to understand where you're at. Because in that situation, it's like, Prabhupada, I just want to dedicate my life to you and surrender to you, and I just want to take sannyas and travel around the world and do nothing else. And that sentiment is good, but a lot of that was not our desire. It was coming from Prabhupada's mercy and the enthusiasm of the other devotees. And we mistook it as our desire. And it's this really interesting phenomenon, isn't it? Because you get inspired and you have all these strong desires and you think, these are my desires, when a lot of times they're just the mercy of the other devotees, the mercy of your spiritual master, that you have those desires. And you look in your heart and you realize, well, if you took that away, where would I be? What level would I be on? And that's the reality, right? Beyond my attractions, beyond my repulsions, beyond just getting pushed by the sangha, which we need to get pushed, there's a level that I'm dealing with. And that's how you understand how to manage your life. Yes.
So bhakti, can we say that to experience the bhakti is it comes from your heart. I mean, the motivation is not exactly your guru. It's, I don't understand.
Well, we're highly influenced by our environment and association. So, you're here in Mayapur, right? So you're being influenced by Mayapur, right? So you can experience your Krishna consciousness differently here because of the environment. But just like yesterday, there was Srila Jaya Pataka Maharaj's Vyas Puja. How many devotees were there? Like 3,000 devotees here? So, you know, 3,000, 4,000 devotees, Vyas Puja. Okay, that's pretty inspiring just to see all these devotees and hear them speak and glorify their spiritual master. So if you're sitting in there, you'll get inspired. Or you're hearing about Jaya Pataka Maharaj and all the things he does, and you're thinking, this is amazing, if I could just be like a particle of that somewhere in my life in the future, if I could do a particle of what he did, that would just be amazing. So you're like completely inspired, right? Isn't it? It's just like, I want to do something like that, you know. Let's spread Krishna consciousness. He's spreading it so incredibly around the world. Let's do it. So you naturally get inspired by that, right? But at the same time, you have to look at yourself and say, really, where am I at? You know, how strong is my desire? Could I actually do that? Or is that just a momentary fleeting desire, which I hope to cultivate at some point in future? But right now, I just want a nice car and a nice house and 5 kids and a lot of money. That's really what I want. This is like I'm in, you know, it's like they asked Prabhupada about, I think the power of a drama. Because Prabhupada said dramas are very powerful, or the power of dance. And he said it's powerful, but the motivation, it's temporary. It comes, like when you watch it, it comes, you get, but you always go back to who you are. And the hope is that these inspirational moments will upgrade you, right? So you're feeling like, wow, I just want to preach, you know, but then you go home, you go back to your country and you deal with all the stuff you have to deal with. So where's that desire to save the world? Right now I'm trying to figure out how to pay my bills. That's what's important to me. And I'm not ready to just go out and save the world. So sitting in that temple, that desire was coming to you, but how much of that actually did you get? So Prabhupada's saying that, like, sometimes you're in these environments and they're very inspirational, but it doesn't last. So you have to be able to take that inspiration. Every day you're taking inspiration. Every day you're here and you're getting purified. But it's that level that you're on that's going to determine your day-to-day quality of your day-to-day service and what you can achieve. And but at the same time, you see that very young devotees have very broad desires to save people and spread Krishna consciousness. And I think this is why Prabhupada emphasized spreading Krishna consciousness so much, because it's so purifying, and it's so in a sense easy to have these desires to save and help other people, because it's just inherent within Krishna consciousness. It's inherent within what Krishna consciousness is, and it's inherent, I think, within the sensibilities of human beings who want to help others. So we just elevate it to help people through Krishna consciousness, and that desire uplifts us. But our ability to do that will correspond with our level of Krishna consciousness. Because if you want to help people, you have to have enough dedication to give yourself to do it. Right? Now, you may be a dedicated person. So despite your level of Krishna consciousness, you'll have a lot of dedication. And that may be normal for you. So that happens also. It's a combination of many things. So the other aspect of your question is that you can always desire to serve Krishna purely, no matter what level of bhakti you're on. So you're taking the inspiration from your guru, the instructions from Prabhupada, from the sangha, from the dham. You're taking it, and then you're bringing it upon yourself, and then you're cooking something with it. And when, you know, you may cook something, and you may cook something, and it all may be different, but you're taking the same ingredients. So we're all getting the same inspiration, and according to our ability, hopefully, we're manipulating it and it's working on us to become more advanced. But just because your inspiration yesterday was, you know, on the top of Mount of the Himalayas, super high, it doesn't mean it's going to last. For somebody else who's more advanced, yeah, they're already halfway up to the Himalayas. That just knocked them up closer. And they'll stay there. You see? So maybe you're on the bottom of the Himalayas, now you're, you know, 100 yards up now. But so that's how it works. And that's why so many people were so inspired by Prabhupada, and when he left, they couldn't do it. Because it has to go deeper. It has to actually wear off on you. Right? Like if your digestion isn't good, then you eat, you don't get much. So the healthier you are, the more you digest. So that's what we're trying to do in Krishna consciousness. We definitely want to get inspired. There's no question. But we always have to balance it with a realistic view of where we're at, so we know what our capabilities and limitations are. You know, I want to go, I want to start this temple in this little village in India and save the poor children, start an orphanage, make them devotees, live in a hut, you know. Then you go out and do it and you realize, I'm not ready to do that austerity. I don't have that much compassion. I mean, if the orphanage is already there, I'll go and I'll work. I'd like to do that. And if I have a nice place to live, and if I'm married and I have a salary, okay, I can. Then you realize I could do that. But to go out and just start it, I'm not there yet. So you want to try to understand these things. And sometimes you don't understand until you do it. Maybe you think you're on that level of austerity, and then you do it and you realize, I can't do this. I have too many other desires that I neglected, and I'm realizing I have to fulfill them just to be stable. So it just, you know, it takes time to understand. But Prabhupada, he was okay with wherever we were at, because wherever we were at, he would say, okay, that's fine, just go and spread Krishna consciousness. Do it with your wife. Do it. Live at a home. Live in the temple. Start a temple. Have 5 kids. He was that for Prabhupada, that wasn't an issue. It's like nothing was an issue. Nothing should stop you from spreading Krishna consciousness. It's just like, well, whatever. What he would say when someone want to get married, he'd say, go in the ashram where you're comfortable. That's all. If you're some people are comfortable as sannyasis. They can't live as grihasthas. Okay. They never get married because they're uncomfortable. They would be uncomfortable as a grihastha. Somebody is uncomfortable as a brahmacharya. All right, so get married, be peaceful, be normal, and now go for it. And so, you know, Prabhupada never made anybody feel that they can't achieve their highest goals because of their ashram. But at the same time, he wanted us to understand there are limitations of each ashram. There are duties in each ashram. So it's a balance. You know, you don't want to make people think once you get married you can't preach. You don't want to make them think at the same time you can just do anything you want. You have a family to be responsible for, and so you have financial considerations and so forth. Right? Like for us, as grihasthas, if we're preaching, we have to see how that preaching will bring an income. Because otherwise we have to bring an income in another way. So it's something different than what a brahmachari has to think about. He doesn't have to think about that. He goes out and preaches. If money comes or doesn't come, it's not such a problem. If you're a grihastha, then you think, if I want to preach, how will I get people to either support me through donations, or how will I get non-devotees to come and pay for my services? Then I can do it. Right? So that's just how Prabhupada wanted us to think. You know, otherwise, as an immature grihastha, we would say, just go out and preach and Krishna will provide. So that's fine. You know, you go out with your wife, but you know, you don't have a place to stay tonight and you're living, you know, in a park. I don't think your wife's going to like that. Maybe one night she'll tolerate it. But those things were happening. Yes. So, there's a question here. What did Prabhupada mean when he said half his mission was not completed because he didn't establish Varnashram? Prabhupada meant that there's a, in his own words, that everyone's not ready just to fully surrender to Krishna and be Vaishnavas. And so Varnashram is a social structure which can engage more people, and gradually becoming Krishna conscious. Right now we're basically pulling in Brahminical people. But Prabhupada noticed, he said, all the people we're pulling in, even though we're living a Brahminical lifestyle, not so Brahminical. So, it, you know, a lot of people are, you know, they have a hard time following regular principles, chanting 16 rounds, but they're devotees. And so now in ISKCON, it's kind of like, well, if you can't do that, you don't, you're not considered up to the standard. In Varnashram, you work according to your Varna and your ashram, and you don't have to immediately get forced into a very Brahminical situation if that's not your nature. So it's a way to go more broad for the world. And it's kind of, you know, until we have it, you'll always find that some devotees are in awkward situations because they don't feel qualified to live Brahminically, but that's all there is. That's the only choice. Four regular principles, 16 rounds, that's the standard. That's a Brahminical standard. Some people just like to work. They can work hard all day. You find this in Gurukul. Some boys don't fit in there. They're not Brahminical. They're just, right? You have to, I mean, we didn't understand that in the early days. It was understood later. That these boys are spoiling it for the other boys because they don't want to be there. The boys that want to be there, they're great. Ones that don't want to be there, well, it brings everyone down. Right? You experience that?
Yeah, I was one of them.
One of the chatrias?
Yes. I never played the Brahmana type.
Yeah, yeah. One of the chatrias. Chatria? Vaishya?
Chatria.
Wants to protect the world. Varnashram is a big topic. But Prabhupada establishes movement, his Brahminical movement, then Varnashram meant, now how do we catch the rest of the world? How can we engage people? And then you'll see Prabhupada talked a lot about this material society, at the rate it's going, it won't last, and we need to have communities. And we can establish communities, because the community means the social structure. We can establish the social structure, not on democracy, not on communism, socialism, but Varnashram. It's a social structure. And that way we can involve people who are not Brahminical in gradually coming to a Brahminical position. So that part of the mission has not been established and stressed. Then the other question, I have to listen again to your sacred union workshops, but it's difficult to be balanced when entering into marriage life. How can we balance those extremes? I don't think you balance, I mean, balance is, you can say externally there may be ways to balance, but you have to become more balanced yourself. If you just try to balance externally, you know, you can regulate a schedule. But you have to, I think balance internally means accepting your responsibilities. It may not even be a question of balance, it may be a question of accepting responsibilities. And once you accept them, then you'll just naturally do them. And you won't even have to try to balance it, it's what you do. I think when you try to do anything and you do it through more of an external method, like, okay, this time I'll do this, this time I'll do that. It can be artificial in the sense that if you internalize what's necessary, then the schedule will come as a byproduct. Does that make sense? Like, once you, if you're a balanced person, your schedule will get balanced. If you work on balancing internally. If you work on accepting, okay, I'm a grihastha, this is just what it means. That's a form of balance. When you can't fully accept what it means, then it becomes difficult for you. And then you don't end up doing all the things you need to do. Then you get out of balance. What I understand, it's taken a bit of seeing my own ego, is that any enthusiasm I've had or had was or is because of others. That I am sensitive. Well, I mean, that's true for all of us, but it should, what we want to do is, okay, let's talk about this, this is important. Like, you go into a situation, you get good association, right? And then you're fired up. And then you go back home, and it's like, and you just come back to what? The reality of who you are. You know, I thought I was the greatest thing that ever happened. I was so fired up on the parikrama, but then I come back and I realize I can't even get up in the morning. I don't even want to get out of bed and I don't finish my rounds and this and that. So how do you deal with that? The point is, and a lot of devotees have this problem, they leave India, they go back to their lives, and they just kind of, you know, sometimes they actually go worse because they become discouraged because they were doing so well in India. When they go back, they're not doing well. It's like, why even try? Like, I'm not even going back to India again. It's like useless. Because I just come back to this situation and it's like nothing happened. And it's very discouraging. So what's supposed to happen is when you're here or in any environment which is helping you, you're supposed to get the help, imbibe it within you, make it part of you, so when you leave that environment, you actually got something from it. Right? Like I travel a lot, right? So naturally, when I travel, I try to inspire people. And so sometimes I'll get a letter and they'll say, I'm very inspired when you were here and I was doing really well, but now that you're gone, that's basically what the letter says. I'm just back to my normal self, right? So that means they were getting inspiration, but they weren't imbibing it. They were just, you know, naturally you're an inspiring environment. Unless you're fighting against it, you'll be inspired, right? But you have to imbibe it also. You have to take it and get it to stick. Something has to stick from that. Yesterday Abhyas put you, what did I get? What's going to stick? What inspiration is going to stick from that? Something, you know. What did I get? What did I understand? What could I imbibe from that? What is it about Jiva Thakur Maharaj that is making him so successful that I could imbibe a little bit of that in my life and try to be that way? So that's, what from this class am I getting that I can imbibe? What from this association that I get every day here in the temple, from other, what can I imbibe and take with me? That's number one. And I think the other thing that we have to be thinking is that every day of my life I have to improve and be better. Because if you don't think that way, you think, oh, when I go back to my country, I'm just going to fall into Maya. You already expect it. And you're planning on it. And you're prepared for it. So when it happens, you actually create it. Because that's how you're thinking. It's the way the mind works. If you expect it, it's going to happen. So better to expect to be able to imbibe all these things. Right? So that's the secret. Take a little bit with you from every good situation. Take what comes, and what's bad, don't let it touch you. As we sometimes we're the opposite, right? The bad is what we take, and the good bounces off us. It's supposed to be the other way around. I mean, it's true, the bad really, people take the bad a lot, and they bounce off the good. So just switch it around. So it's important to try to somehow or other imbibe on the deepest level the good, so it has some transformational effect on us. So everything's changing us, every sangha is changing us a little bit. We're getting something from it. What did we learn? You have to do that to go on in Krishna consciousness throughout your life. Even if your spiritual master does not leave, but if you're not always in his sangha, you're not always getting that, you have to be able to imbibe all the things you got from him to go on, right? Like so many of our spiritual masters have already left, and they've given their disciples so much. So if the disciples take that as if what they spoke 20 years ago was spoken today. My Guru Maharaj said, he always said this. And you've taken it and you're doing it, you'll see those disciples are very alive today. And this is transcendental, it has nothing to do with presence, like physical presence. So it's good to be inspired. At the same time, we don't just want to take an inspiration that's temporary, we want to imbibe it. You know, like sometimes a person will hear a song or see a movie and it'll change their life. People will say, that song changed my life. Wow, one song changed your life. But that, I saw that movie, changed my life. The you know, the actor, the things that he went through, the challenges. There is a, I think it was a movie about Helen Keller. She was blind. There's some movie, and what the GBC at that time had all the teachers. I don't know if it was Helen Keller or something. It was some woman who had this incredible determination to deal with, I think, children. And he had all the teachers watch the movie because it was such an inspiration for teachers, for tolerance, for patience. So, you know, so you get some, you know, what did you get? Yeah, that movie changed my life, or that experience changed my life, or that class really opened me up. That's what you wanted. That's what you're trying to get. So naturally, so he says, there's been times I've gone to India, and then by the end of the trip, I thought I was a pure devotee, only to realize that when I got back, everything was the same. Same in Artha, same struggles. And any enthusiasm I still had was just left over. Same goes when I'm with you. The first thing is to think you're a pure devotee just because you're around pure devotees, and they're, you know, it's like, I'm in the sun, that must mean I'm effulgent. No, it means that you're reflecting the sun. And when you go inside, you're not light anymore. The thing is also that we are being affected permanently. Sometimes we don't realize it. But this is, anyway, this is a huge, it's a huge, hugely important topic to be able to learn how to take that association and that enthusiasm and then make it yours. And you can become inspired by thinking about your spiritual master, by thinking about Prabhupada, and thinking about other devotees that inspire you. So when you go back to your country, you can think of all the inspiring devotees here. You can think of your favorite devotees, your spiritual master, how they would act and what they would do. To me, I feel like I remember how I felt with you or in India gives strength. Yeah, exactly. It's like I get a glimpse now and I have to struggle for more. Just like I like listening to Prabhupada's morning walk, because on his morning walks he talks a lot of it about preaching, and just the whole, there's a very revolutionary mood in the morning walk. And that's Prabhupada's mood, and I always connect with that mood, and the more I'm connected, the better. So if you have something inside of you, you'll resonate with someone outside of you. So generally, when you get inspired by something, there must be something inside that's resonating with it. Can't be completely absent. Otherwise, why would you get inspired? You know what I'm saying? You get inspired by something. There must be something in you. So you realize, that's in me. Let me realize what it is in me that's getting inspired, resonating by this, and let's magnify that. Let's remember that. Let's work on it. Let's increase it. Right? One of the things I tell devotees when they leave India or after we have a retreat, and I think it's extremely important, is when you leave, don't think it's not going to last, but think how to make it last. How can I take this? Because otherwise everybody thinks, I know when I go back it's not going to last. And that's a guarantee that it won't. Whereas if you go back thinking, how can I make this last? What can I do to make it last? How can I keep it within me? Then you're in a different mindset. So many devotees, they always say, I know it's not going to last. I know when I leave the japa retreat, I'm not going to chant good rounds. And I said, yeah, you're absolutely correct. You're not. Because anyone who thinks like this will not chant good rounds. Rather, you've learned so many things. Now go out thinking how for the rest of my life I can apply these things. Right? That's a different mindset. So, So the balance is your ideal is very high and it enthuses you, and your reality is where you're at. So you balance those. Just because your ideal is high and you're low, you don't say, well, I can't do that. No, the ideal is what inspires you. But you work according to your level, so you don't fall on your face and try to, you know, like, you know, let's go stretch. Everybody stretch. And you think, okay, I'm just going to stretch down and put my hands flat on the floor. And all of a sudden you pull all the tendons because you haven't stretched in a year. So you have to stretch slowly. Okay, so just understand you'll get there. That's your goal, but stretch slowly. In a few days you'll be able to do it. That's all. So there's a philosopher who said, you can have your head in the clouds if you have your feet on the ground. So that's the idea. Realistic. Mm-hmm. So, one more question. Anuradha had a question. You remember your question? You forgot.
The way we do know our real level is by our actions? Or
how do you know what level you're really at?
Yes.
Your actions are one, but your actions may not always be indicative. How to know where you're at, how to be honest about yourself.
Yeah.
Wow. I think the false ego is the mechanism which prevents us from being realistic about where we're at, because sometimes I think we have two mechanisms. One mechanism is we don't want to look at it, because if we see it, it's like we have to admit we're not as Krishna conscious as the other devotee that joined the same time we did, or the young brahmachari who's only been a devotee 10 years or 5 years and I've been 30, 40, and he's, that's hard to look at. Or the false ego will just say you're incredibly fallen, and that becomes an excuse for not having to try, because now there's no competition. I'm just the most fallen, I'm just rascal number one, and everyone's better than me, so I'll just well in, you know, the mode of ignorance, and it's okay. And that's, I think, how the false ego deals with it, which both are not realistic. So a devotee was just written me a letter, and he was having trouble with the fourth principle. You know what the fourth principle is? Remember I said long ago, I said we should write a book and we'll call it The Fourth Principle, and everyone will know. The fourth principle. You know that principle that's like really hard to follow? The fourth one? You could call it the fifth principle, but there's only four. So he's having trouble with the fourth principle. Not gambling. Not being vegetarian. Not smoking pot. But the fourth principle, the tough one, right? So he's having trouble with the fourth principle. And he was talking about it to me. And he said, I've never talked about it with anybody, and it feels really good to talk about it, really therapeutic and really helpful, right? So I think that's the trouble. It's like we don't even want to talk about it with ourselves, just like deal with it realistically. So, but we don't want to deal with our problems realistically in a way where we become discouraged and go, oh my God, look at me, I'm so like this. It's just to monitor. Like I put you on a motorcycle, right? I put you on a Royal Enfield. You can get a Royal Enfield 500cc motorcycle. You could probably go 120 kilometers an hour on that motorcycle once you get out on the open road. Now the question is, how fast are you capable of driving? You go, what? You get on and you go, I like to drive 120. Yeah, but can you? Because if you fall off the bike at 120, that's going to be pretty dangerous. Why don't you just drive like 40 and get used to it? Then 50, then 60. So, it's not that you can't maintain your ideal. You just have to understand what you're capable of shooting for in a way that you can remain steady and safe. And so then, and also be happy about others who are more advanced than you. And know what your capabilities are, and know where your lackings are. And then just work on your lackings, and work with your capabilities. Work with what you're good at. I mean, you could have a whole seminar on this topic, you know, how to understand where you're at. But because one thing you'll see is you'll connect with you'll realize I'm in a certain space, right? And I have certain needs. But then when you get in good association, you become detached from those needs temporarily. The problem is when you think you're actually detached. Because in that association, those things seem to feel stupid. Like, why am I thinking about this? That's just stupid. Why am I meditating on this, these attachments of sense? It just feels stupid. Because now you're in the association with all these very renounced people who are blissful, and they're giving classes about going back to Godhead and everything in this world is temporary. And all of a sudden you're just thinking, all these attachments I have, they're stupid, right? But at that point, you have to be balanced enough to realize, I have those. And if I think I don't have those, then I'll try to renounce them, and they're not going to actually go away. They're still there. So that happens to all of us, doesn't it? You get in good association, all of a sudden you think you're up here. You're still down here. You're just temporarily up here by that inspiration. That kirtan was amazing. I'm up here. Right? But tomorrow morning, I still have trouble getting out of bed. But that kirtan has done something to me. It's knocked me up a notch, and sometimes imperceptible. It's not. So you have to be able to get that inspiration, run with it, take it, use it to uplift you, but realize that what's happening in that situation is you're getting an inspiration. It's like, it's not going to last. It only lasts as long as that environment is there, which is why we try to be in the best environment we can. But still, we want to take that inspiration and uplift ourselves and realize, don't ever forget who you are and where you're at and what you're dealing with. And if you're just a little honest with yourself, you realize, this is what I'm dealing with. And we have to do that to be humble, because if we don't do that, we can't be humble. Right? Like so many of my God brothers are being glorified. And then they think I'm great. If they actually knew what I was really like, they wouldn't glorify me. You know, sometimes I'll glorify my God, but like, oh yeah, if you really knew what I was like, you wouldn't say that. So that's how you remain humble, because you are not pretending you don't have anarthas. You are very aware of your anarthas. And that's how you remain humble. So somebody glorifies you, you take it humbly and said, I'm really not that great. You just think I am. No, I see that you're great. My greatness is that I can act in spite of those anarthas, but I know what those anarthas are, and so I'm realistic about it. Then I can remain humble. Right? If I forget those anarthas, then when people say I'm great, I'll think, yeah, you're right, I am great. And that's the beginning of the end of your Krishna consciousness, when you think you're great. So, okay, you know, if I have any good quality, I can act in spite of my anarthas. I realize that I have so many faults. And I realize I have so much envy and jealousy and so many things. But at least I can deal with it in a way that I can continue my Krishna consciousness, and I have to work on it. And so when you're aware of it, then you can work on it. And if you're not aware of it, how do you work on it? Because you don't know what to work on. You come in, you're the repairman, and you come into the house. Where's the problem? And the wife says, the lady of the house says, I don't know. I said, ma'am, I need to work on, you know, where's the noise coming from? I don't know. Where's the crack? You said there's a crack. I don't know. So how can you work on your anartha if you don't know where it is and what it is? So just being aware. And then you can, you know, how can you not be aware? Some devotee comes in the temple, right, really good devotee, and they're getting, you can see they're getting so much facility and they're doing so many things you want to do, and something your heart is going, you know, I don't like that. You know, I'm just as good as them, and why are they more successful? Immediately, if you're conscious, you realize, envy. Okay, so then you tell yourself, look, I'm envious. I should be happy. I have to work on this. I need to learn how to be happy when other people are successful. So, or you see another beautiful man, beautiful woman, you think, wow, I really like to talk to him. Oh, lust, immediately, I got to work on this. You see, so how could you not be aware? Only when you're proud, you deny these things because you want to tell yourself you're great. And if you have all these things, how can you tell yourself you're great? Because if you're dealing with them and, you know, confronting them, I'm envious, I'm lusty, I'm attached, I'm artificially detached, you're dealing with all these things, then you remain humble. And then you can improve them, you can work on them, because you know they're there. So false ego doesn't want us to think like that. It's like, I'm great.
How to work on it?
Let's have a workshop, 11 hours a day for a week, to work on the false ego. Chisel. One of the ways to work on it is Mahatma's famous saying, which we call, we're naming now Mahatmaisms. It's okay to be fallen. It's okay to be fallen. That's where you start. It's okay to be fallen. So you find yourself envious or attached. It's okay. It's normal. I'm a conditioned soul. It's normal. I just have to work on it. Let's work on it. When the false ego, it has a need to feel that we're special in some way. So then the false ego can't say, it's okay that I'm envious. No, the false ego say, you're not envious. That guy's just a jerk. And that's just how it is. You're not envious at all. That's what the false ego says. You're better. Everybody knows you're better. And only people that think he's better are basically crazy people. They have no taste. They don't know what good is. So that's what the false ego will do. So, but when you say it's okay to it's normal to be fallen and have all these attachments, your false ego doesn't get in the way, because it's just, did you realize, unless I acknowledge them, I can't work on them. So I have to acknowledge them to work on them. And my false ego is going to prevent that from happening. Right? Does that make sense? So, it's okay to be fallen. No problem. And the second half of the sentence, as long as you work on it. It's okay to be fallen as long as you work on it. It's not okay to be fallen and not work on it, because that's counterproductive. It's normal, it's okay to be fallen, it's normal to be fallen. Don't be excited about, don't be amazed by the contamination you find in your heart. Don't be amazed by it. There's a lot of stuff there. There's a lot. Well, you know, it shouldn't amaze you. It's been planted in there for thousands of years. As long as you're working on it, everything's okay. As long as, that's what, the point where we should be upset about ourselves is to not work on it. That's the dangerous point. Right? So false ego wants to block you from realizing it. But the real danger is that you don't work on it. So it's not a problem if you realize it, it's a problem if you don't work on it. And so it's healthy if you realize it. It's a problem if you don't realize it. Healthy if you realize it, because you're being humble. You're pushing your false ego aside. So just work on it. And that's what it's all about. And if you work on it, you get better. Anything you put your mind to, you'll get better at. So if you find an anartha, you work on it, you'll improve. And that's why when we leave India or we leave these nice environments, we should always be in the mood of improvement. And I find for myself, if I'm in the mood of always improving, anywhere I go is the same. India, outside India, any country. Every country I go is a different environment. And I don't feel it. I feel it's the same. Because I'm in the same consciousness. I just always want to work on myself. Here it's easier. So there it means a little more effort. But it's the same mood. I'm always improving myself. So I don't feel this up and down. I go to a japa workshop to improve myself. I leave the japa workshop. I continue to improve my japa. It's the same. It doesn't drop out. Right? So, it's okay to be fallen as long as you work on it. Sound good?
Yes.
Okay. Krankra shows us many people needed to see therapists after leaving the movie theaters from seeing Avatar because they were so inspired and pulled into a magical world. But as soon as they left and went home, they realized how miserable their lives were. Oh my God. Okay, if that ever happens to you after coming to the Holy Dawn, then use it as an impetus to improve yourself. That's all. That's all I can say is use it as an impetus to improve yourself. That's the... Here's a better way to think of it. When you are confronted with your anarthas and your faults, when you actually have an avatar experience, like he's describing, then you should think, now I'm fortunate because I see where I need to work. This is good because I'm just seeing what was already there that I didn't see. And now I can see it, so it's good. Now that I can see it, I can work on it. That's all. And don't become discouraged or depressed. It's just the way it is. And everybody's dealing with it. Every single devotee in the Hare Krishna movement has the same challenge. You're not unique. Everybody's dealing with the same things. Kaam, krodh, lobh, moha, matsara. Everybody deals with it to one degree or another. Everyone is attracted to the opposite sex. Everyone wants to possess. Everyone wants to enjoy. Everyone wants to control. Everyone is envious, jealous. Everyone has to deal with anger, lust, greed. Everybody. So don't think that you're alone in this. Everybody's dealing with this. We're all going through it. So if you find it in your heart, you're not unique. Everybody has it. So don't be alarmed. Don't be shocked. Don't be discouraged. Don't be depressed or disappointed. Just think, oh, this is good. Krishna's mercy. I'm making advancement. I can see my problems. These disciples went to Bhakti Siddhanta. They said, 20 years we're chanting. We still don't chant well. He said, I'm so happy to hear this. I said, why are you happy? He said, because if you told me you're chanting well, I would be worried that you're becoming proud. Now I can see you're still humble. So if you feel that you have some faults, that's humility. The problem is when you get discouraged by it. That's the mode of ignorance. So if you say I have the fault and you're in the mode of goodness, then you work to deal with it, improve yourself. So that's normal. That's how we should be. So as long as don't be afraid to see the fault and take it in the mode of goodness and do something to improve yourself. Then you're good. Okay? Is that all right? And that is exactly how Prabhupada was. That's why we got on this point. Because Prabhupada didn't care. You got married, this and that. It just spread Krishna consciousness. It doesn't matter. From whatever position you're in, it doesn't matter. As long as you want to improve, that's what's important. There's a saying, it's not where you're at, it's where you're looking to go that's important. We're all on different levels. But the person who's looking to go to the high level will eventually get there. You may be higher than me, but if I'm looking higher than you, I'll end up better in the long run. So that's what's most important for us. What's your ideal? What inspires you? Don't be discouraged by your fault. Be inspired by where you want to go. And then you're good. No problem. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so we can end here? Finished? Prabhupada's amazing. Krishna consciousness is amazing. Always be enthusiastic, don't be discouraged, and take all the association you can get, imbibe it, take it with you. This is what great people do. If you study successful people, one thing you'll find is they studied other successful people. That's how they became successful. They studied success. It wasn't like they just figured everything out. They took from everybody and they learned. So they if you learn from every experience, you get something, you imbibe it, you put it within your encyclopedia of what you need to grow in Krishna consciousness, then you'll keep growing. Every bad experience, every good experience, every ecstatic kirtan, every unecstatic kirtan, every ecstatic class, every unecstatic class, every inspiring situation, every difficult situation, you learn, you take it, it all becomes a source of further advancement. That's what successful people do. They're always learning from everything. They're always reading, studying, learning, expanding, growing. So in every situation, they're growing. If they go into a bad environment, they learn from it. They learn what not to do. Oh, this environment is toxic. It's dysfunctional. This person is like this. Oh, that's teaching me what not to do. They don't get discouraged. They just learn what not to do because they're always growing. Isn't it? That's how successful people are. They grow. Like good investors make money when the market's up, they make it when the market's down. Right? So you can be in a bad situation and learn a lot. It's like, why is this situation bad? Successful people, they'll always look at, okay, here's a bad situation. Why is it bad? By understanding why is it bad, you understand how to make it good. Right? Like so many things we're doing with Soul Tools, with our company, is because of me seeing bad things. So I'm saying, we should do this. How can I say we should do this? Because I'm saying, it's another way of saying, don't do that. Do this, because I've seen that doesn't work, so we're going to do this. So you learn from what doesn't work. Right? Or you go into a certain situation, it doesn't work for you. It's not helping you. So you learn. That situation is bad for me. I can't do that. As long as you're learning, everything is good. Right? Okay, so we'll end now. Thank you all for listening. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gopremananda, Hari Hari Hari.